Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on New Books in Intellectual History, we have Dr. Graham Russell Gow Hodges, who is the George Dorlin Langdon Jr. Professor of History and Africana Studies at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York. He is the author of Black New Jersey, 1664 to the present day. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hodges.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. Very pleasure. My pleasure to be here.
I appreciate you doing this interview. Black New Jersey is a unique text in that it is the first survey history of African Americans in New Jersey history from the colonial era to the present day. First, we will discuss Dr. Hodges' biography and some thoughts on intellectual history in general. And then we will engage in a more detailed discussion of Black New Jersey. It's also important to note that Black New Jersey is an award-winning text and well-deserved. Dr. Hodges, please tell us some more about your teaching and research interests.
Sure. I have been teaching at Colgate University for over three decades. My bread and butter is early American history, so I teach the survey and more advanced courses in American history up to 1877. I also have done a lot of courses on New York City history, some on Asian American history. And I should also say, in terms of our conversation today, that when I teach early American history, I include a substantial amount of African American history because, of course, Blacks are so important to early America. My research interests are varied. My first book was on the New York City cartmen, who were drivers of two-wheeled carts between 1667 and 1850. And they're the natural ancestors of cab drivers. So I later did a book called Taxi, A Social History of the New York City Cab Driver. After doing my first book, I became very involved in the Black history of New Jersey and New York City. And I've done a number of books on that, including Root and Branch, African Americans in New York and East Jersey, 1667-1863. Black New Jersey, also did a book on David Ruggles, a Black abolitionist in the Underground Railroad in New York City. In addition to the Taxi book, I branched out to do a biography of Anna Mae Wong, from Landryman's Daughter to Hollywood Legend. This is the story of the foremost Asian American actress ever. And I did a triple biography of Tadeusz Kosciuszko, Thomas Jefferson, and Agrippa Hall, and a pact between Jefferson and Kosciuszko, which has New Jersey relevance, about Kosciuszko awarding all of his lifetime earnings to freeing Blacks and educating them and giving them land in America. Jefferson never did it, but Gary Nash and I did a book on that about 10 years ago. So I've got a number of things under the belt already, a lot of documentary histories, but I'm always working and looking at new projects.
Yes, I think it's important to note that Dr. Hodges is a prolific scholar of 16 books or more.
About 9 books written by myself, and then about another 8 or 9 books, I kind of lost count, that I've edited. One, for example, is Pretends to Be Free, Runaway Slave Notices from Colonial Revolutionary New York and New Jersey, and that was published back in 1994. And I was really pleased to do a 25th anniversary edition this last year, because those runaway notices are terrific capsule texts of ordinary people who self-emancipated. And we learned a lot about who they were, what they looked like, their intellectual interests, their skills. And it's a terrific book. So I've had a lot of fun doing documentary history books like that.
Okay. So you mentioned that you've done some work on New York and New Jersey. So how did you come to study the history of African Americans in New Jersey in particular? Why not another state like Pennsylvania?
Well, I've lived much of my life in New York City. But when I finished my PhD back in 1982, and the world yawned in indifference, my mentor, Carl Prince, who's a very prominent New Jersey historian, hired me as an associate editor on the William Livingston papers. Of course, he is New Jersey's revolutionary era governor. One of the letters that I was working on, and this is after I'd already gotten the project on the Cartman, I'd done his dissertation and was about to publish it as a book. One of the letters had to do with a man named Colonel Ty, who was a self-emancipated person who had belonged to John Corley's from Monmouth County. And Ty later came back he escaped in 1775, came back a couple of years later as a leader of a motley crew of whites and blacks who raided the Patriot lines, kidnapped people, took cattle over to the British line, did all kinds of things for the British. And so these letters were appeals to Governor Livingston to declare martial law so that the locals could defend themselves against Colonel Ty. And I really got into this guy, and I thought, this is fascinating, because, you know, we use the method whereby every letter has to have full annotations. I had to learn about him, about the people that he captured, about the places where he made his raids, all of these things to create the context of this intellectual document, this letter. And with that, I noticed that New Jersey had very little work done on the history of Black people, of enslavement and freedom, back to its origins, or for that matter, up to the present. And so I thought, this is interesting. I kind of got into it and I got hooked. And now, almost 40 years later, I'm still working on it.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing that you note, that much of the work on the history of African Americans in New Jersey, obviously, there are many scholars who've been working towards, you know, laying the groundwork. But this book is, you know, it's so important in terms of why I wanted to interview you, is that it's really the first comprehensive survey history published by an academic press that gives us a sweep of African-American history in New Jersey. And if we could elaborate a little bit on this role of African-Americans in early New Jersey history, I think many people either overlook, or maybe the old saying, New Jersey gets overlooked by New York. But people forget the role that African Americans play in the early history of the state. Could you say some more about the importance of African Americans in the colonial era?
African Americans are critical to the development of the colony and later the state of New Jersey from its origins, even the pre-colonial times, when New Jersey's Olympian adjunct of New Netherlands in the 1620s, up through the establishment of the colony in 1664. New Jersey's Black population is the critical mass of laborers throughout the colonial period, and really substantial. I mean, places like Bergen County, enslaved people are 40% of the population, of all the population, in the 1730s and 1740s. And that's that kind of representation is true throughout the colony. And after the Revolution, they continue to be significantly important. New Jersey is the last northern state to establish a Gradual Emancipation Act in 1804. It's heavily contested by slave owners, and there are still enslaved people under kind of an obscure permanent indentured servitude status as late as the 1850s and early 1860s. In fact, right. One of the things I did a book on Monmouth County on slavery and freedom in the rural North, was to find fugitive slave notices published in the Monmouth Democrat in 1857. Imagine that.
Wow.
You know, they're still trying to hunt these people down who have escaped from freedom. Now, back to your point about New Jersey being overlooked. Famously, New Jersey is regarded as a pitcher with two spouts, one of them at Philadelphia and the other in New York. And of course, these big metropolises overshadow New Jersey in some ways, but Jersey feeds Philadelphia and New York in the same way that today New Jersey is an extremely important bedroom community for workers in New York. Newark is a sizable city on its own. New Jersey combines rural and urban populations as almost no other state. And one of the little factoids that I like to mention is that there are about 30 million people living between the Philadelphia Airport and City Island in Northern Bronx in New York. And of that, a substantial portion are African American. Indeed, about 20% of all blacks in the United States live in that straight line between New York and Philadelphia, and a lot of them are in Jersey. So it's a history which must be told because it's significant. And as the great historian of New Jersey, Marion Thompson Wright, once mentioned, it's in New Jersey that you find all of the variations of black freedom and slavery.
Right, exactly. It's another aspect of New Jersey history is often said that it's both the North and the South at the same time.
Yes.
And that has implications for the colonial era through the Civil Rights era, which we'll get to a little bit when we talk more about your book. You mentioned these ads and the importance of these as a sort of expression of thought or intellectual history. And we could now turn our focus to this idea of what is intellectual history. It just made me think of this notion of maybe the intellectualism of the everyday or everyday intellectualism that people, you know, engage in. Everybody has the capacity to think.
Mm-hmm.
So your book gets into a discussion of, you know, black elites and professionals. And so oftentimes we think of intellectual history as a discussion of elites, academics, or professionals. So my question is, what is intellectual history and how does the term relate to the history of New Jersey?
The intellectual history, very formally, is the history of ideas and thinkers, and it's kind of closely associated with the history of philosophy. And it depends on whether you regard it in sort of a Platonic sense that histories are that ideas are separate from human beings, that they sort of exist in this heavenly atmosphere, or if you, and I think this is more the way it's done now, regard intellectual thought within context. And context can mean the historiography of ideas, or it can mean something that's heavily influenced by a series of variables, whether that would be economics or society, race, gender, even religion. All of these things are, as you had pointed out, ideas that are produced by histories, by people, regardless of their rank in society. And that the fact that we have someone who's a very esteemed philosopher from the University of Oxford, his ideas are in context in the same way that a laborer from Bergen Counties would be in the 1750s. All of these people are thinking, right. And what they're thinking about is what we find fascinating. So when we think about someone like Mark, who is a preacher who escapes from his master in 1774, Mark is described as someone who's, you know, a very powerful thinker, someone who has a lot to say about important subjects. The things his master says about Mark after he's fled from slavery. So here's Mark, who is, in some ways a very ordinary guy, but someone who also is capable of, as they say, has much to say on the subject of religion. Well, that's kind of a history of ideas. We'd like to know more about what Mark said, but we don't have any books by him, but we have an indication that he's thinking and he's talking and he's convincing others.
Right. It's the history of ideas, thought, thinkers.
Yeah. Well, you know, especially because the way we do history in the United States now has been so heavily influenced by the turn to social history in the 1990s. I mean, you know, Joan Scott's major idea about gender as a category of history in 1987, that influences everything. So, you know, we really now see all actions, all thinking in terms of a social context.
Right. Right. Much of, I mean, I introduced the book by saying it's a survey, but the point that you said, you know, it's also about context when we talk about human thought and ideas. And so you give us this, I think, with many particular individuals like Marion Thompson Wright. We give her the category of intellectual. She's got a PhD, and we say, obviously, she fits this category. But then there are other individuals, page 217 in your book, talk a little bit about Ernie Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
He's a factory worker.
Yes, a factory worker, an activist, a political organizer.
Right.
Someone who has a very lengthy career, has his successes and his failures. He's an important organizer for unions in New Jersey. His daughter, of course, is now an important professor of religion and sociology at in Columbia University. So, I mean, there's a family. Mm-hmm. Which is very clearly preoccupied with ideas.
Right. Absolutely. And he's writing things down. Ernie Thompson.
Oh, yes.
Is writing speeches. He's co-writing two books with his daughter. And I always find him amazing because he's a factory worker and union organizer. And he's writing things down in the more traditional sense that we think about intellectuals. They write books. They write things down. Well, he's doing that too.
Well, and of course,
amazing.
The thing about African Americans in New Jersey, and they have always been heavily burdened by racist oppression. And this is a case in the colonial era. It was certainly the case after gradual emancipation. There's a brief period during the 1770s when things are a little bit better. Then you get Jim Crow. Lasts well into the 1950s and 1960s. Some people say it never ended. And now we have the more recent discrimination. All of that is to say that African Americans didn't have the access to universities, to tenured positions. They were not encouraged. In fact, they were discouraged from writing. They still produced a lot of books, but it's not the kind of thing that before we would consider to be part of an intellectual stream because they're really outside. You know, they're behind the veil, as Du Bois would put it. Right. And they're not seen as part of intellectual history. But, of course, they're critical to it. And they're critical to the understanding of America. And I think our current predicament shows just how much race and the history of Black people is paramount to understand the United States.
Right. I think one more question before we get into some more details of the book. Well, two things really is you obviously discussed the history of women in New Jersey history, Marion Thompson Wright, among others, and how much does gender you sort of feature into this history of New Jersey? Women, Black women play a prominent role, I think, throughout the history of New Jersey in important moments when the Constitution gets rewritten and, you know, Black women are there in the suffrage movement. So that's like one area
yes.
that I see.
Well, I think when your very valuable book comes out, we'll learn a lot more about that. But sure, I allude to women, and gender is important because Black women are the backbone of the Black churches of New Jersey, which right. are the primary community and intellectual forces of the state. Someone like Jerina Lee. Who is an evangelical speaker, an ordained exhorter during the 1820s, 1830s, highly influential, for example, on Harriet Tubman, who had met her, someone who influences people in southern New Jersey to help out on the Underground Railroad. So, I mean, those people are there. Women, of course, are there as a primary force from the beginning. And you also have Black women during the colonial period, and we see them through the runaway ads. you know, that they also have a lot to say about various subjects. Or the, you know, that they have attitudes which their masters can barely tolerate, and that shows, you know, that there's a real dialogue and a tension about their freedom seeking. And then, as you point out in your valuable work, there are a series of Black women's clubs, YNWCAs, churches, political organizations in which women are involved in New Jersey from the beginnings of the 20th century right up to the present day. You know, they are significant players. So sure, gender is something that's very important.
Right. I mean, I think the importance of having a survey text like this that feeds into so many different subfields of history, social history, intellectual history, cultural history, religion, and why it's so important, I think people forget that Harriet Tubman, as you said, comes through the state, Joanna Lee, who writes one of the first spiritual autobiographies, and other key thinkers and activists in New Jersey takes us to focus more directly on your book here. And my next question is, who are some of the notable African-Americans in New Jersey history detailed in your book? We sort of began our discussion of some of them.
Well, we did mention Colonel Ty and Jerina Lee. John S. Rock is a Black New Jersey lawyer, Underground Railroad advocate, someone who later moves to Massachusetts and becomes a very prominent lawyer there. George Cannon is a very interesting figure whom I detailed. He's a Lincoln graduate, and we should talk about the importance of Lincoln University for Black New Jersey men. And he's a political figure, a minister. He establishes the Frederick Douglass Motion Picture Theater, which produces several films in the early teens of the 20th century. You know, he's someone who is a devoted Republican Party member and a key activist. This is when the Republican Party was truly the party of Lincoln, not the party of the current administration. Someone like Paul Robeson, and my blanket statement on Paul Robeson, I think is absolutely true, is that the famed actor, singer, political activist, writer, Paul Robeson is the most important person ever produced by the state of New Jersey. And he's born and bred there. He's from Princeton. He goes to Rutgers as one of the first African-Americans. I think he was like third or fourth. Plays football as an All-American player, plays Phi Beta Kappa, first in his class, and then he goes off to world greatness. And so I think he's the greatest person New Jersey ever produced of any race. You know, he's highly significant. And, of course, he's widely known, too. We were going to talk about Marion Thompson right a little bit now or later, but let's also talk about Eric Morrow, who is the first Black man to be an executive assistant to the President of the United States during the Eisenhower administration. And he had been a principal NAACP operative, someone who comes from a very distinguished Hackensack family. That's Hackensack, New Jersey. His brother later becomes an ambassador. His sister, by the way, talking of gender, sister is a highly educated, talented person who was not allowed to teach white students because of her race. You know, and you get the sense from the Morrow family, from others in the 1930s, of their intense bitterness because they know they're as good as the whites, and sometimes they know they're a lot better than the whites who occupy positions, and they're kept out simply by Jim Crow. And it's tough on anybody, and so you just get a sense of these people. They're willing to work hard. They believe in democracy. At the same time, you know, there's this underlying sadness and bitterness, which is very, very strong. And I think it's something that is an emotional and philosophical sensibility that affects us to the present day. Sarah Vaughan is one of the most important jazz singers ever. And she says to people, she said, "You'd have to think of me as Sarah Vaughan from Newark." You know, she goes out to Los Angeles and makes a lot of recordings. She's a world jazz figure, but she's still Sarah from Newark. And when she dies, that's where she's, you know, that's where their funeral is. And that's something telling about that. More recently, and there are other people like this, Imam Omari Baraka is one of the most important figures of the Black Arts Movement, a fascinating a poet, playwright who combines political and artistic visions. He's in New York, and he says, no, I must leave the bohemian world that I'm involved in and go back to Newark and there establish a Black Arts Movement. And he does that. He does his theater there, poetry, community activism, political activism. He's very important in the the Gibson administration in the early 1970s and continues up to his death a few years ago. And, of course, his son now, Ross Baraka, is the mayor of Newark. So these are some of the many, many people that I detail because I like to put capsule biographies in there. I think it's important that we get a sense through a single person the visions and dreams of a family, a community, and of a people.
Right. And that's why is another reason why I wanted to interview you here, because, as you said, you know, one way of doing intellectual history is these, you know, sort of capsule biographies that are interwoven throughout this larger survey of the history of New Jersey. And the names that you just mentioned is really making an argument that feeds into the next question about how uniquely positioned were some members of the Black elite and professional class, like Robeson, who comes from an old elite family, the contributions that women and others make to the jazz era, you know, the development of jazz, the civil rights movement. And could we make the argument that, so New Jersey is central to the Black arts movement, is central to the rise of arts and culture, given that these New Jersey natives who are African Americans, you know, play a larger national role in the history of the country? Could we make that argument that these individuals are uniquely positioned as members of the Black elite professional class that give rise to the civil rights movement in America?
Oh, I think you certainly can make that argument, because beginning in 1881, when New Jersey mandates education for Blacks, now there were slippery areas within that law that allowed for segregation in New Jersey schools for another 70 years. Nonetheless, there were schools established. And as Marion Thompson Wright pointed out, some of those schools in the northern part of the state were really quite good. And so education, because it also combines with the religious vision of New Jersey's people, becomes a significant pathway towards success. And this is a way that Black women, for example, can become involved in activism, okay? That they can step out of their roles as housewives or homemakers into political ways. The way that Black ministers can then expand their vision into politics, okay? The way that Blacks can become critical intellectual thinkers. You know, you mentioned how my book is one of the first surveys. I stand on the shoulders of Clement Price and Giles Wright, who were really significant writers of Black New Jersey history. I couldn't have done it without what they did before.
Right,
and they are part of that the class of, say, 1950s, 1960s, certainly 1970s. Of young Black men and women who go on to be intellectuals. Today, if you have someone like Nell Painter, you know, who is not from New Jersey, but she winds up teaching at Princeton for a long, long time, retires, moves to Newark, and opens an art studio, becomes an artist after many years as an historian. These are the kind of people without whom my book or our whole understanding of Black New Jersey and its intellectual tradition could not be understood. I mean, there are a lot of significant figures. And back to your question, yes, we can say that New Jersey is a significant contributor to national arts and intellectual life.
Right. So feed it into another question about this professional class and the long civil rights movement. There were some important laws that were passed long before 1954 in New Jersey. And there's been, again, a lot of work on New York, and the argument is made that, okay, you know, civil rights activism was happening in New York, but there's some key legislation that happens in New Jersey in the 1940s. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Sure. New Jersey had strong Jim Crow from the 20s to the 40s, for sure. But the Republican Party, which is trying to maintain loyalty of Black New Jerseyans, liberalizes. And this is part of a whole national mood during the 1940s to show that, you know, the American democracy is a genuine cross-racial democracy. We're still working on that. Nonetheless, during the 1940s, you get in 1945 a state anti-discrimination law and the creation of a task force to fight discrimination. 1947, you get key studies of New Jersey schools. And in 48, you get a law against discrimination in schools and other parts of life. Importantly, not in housing. That's something that becomes a judicial issue for decades after that. And one of the reasons why New Jersey still has such strong racial problems today. But right. Those laws, which are precede Brown versus Board of Education and which are really pioneering in national politics, at least establish a framework by which New Jersey can desegregate. It doesn't desegregate, and that's because of the inability to solve housing problems. But even so, the establishment of the integration of schools will create people like Baraka, who goes to an integrated school. He has a hard time of it, but he comes out of there with a pretty good education and goes on to Howard University and later becomes this world figure. And there are a lot of people like that. They're the Black middle class of New Jersey comes out of the opening of the schools, the opening of job opportunities in major organizations like the Prudential Life Insurance Company, okay? And the recognition that with the growth of a Black middle class in New Jersey, that companies have to pay attention to their customer base, establish civil rights divisions within their organizations, hire Blacks as officials in key positions, hire regular Blacks as line workers. You know, this in every way lifts up the race, or at least it gives it its proper status in the state, and establishes a middle class, which is still there. Okay? New Jersey's kind of bifurcated. There are a lot of very poor people, Black people in New Jersey, but they're also a substantial middle class. And that's something which has been developing over the course of the 20th century, but really accelerated by those laws in the 1940s.
Right. And that takes us to one of our last questions regarding Marion Thompson Wright and her role in getting some of these laws passed, like the Hedgepeth Williams versus Trenton Board of Education. As you mentioned, a lot of these things were happening before 1954, and Marion Thompson Wright plays a role. Can you tell us some more about your work on Marion Thompson Wright?
Marion Thompson Wright is one of those figures, you know, I learned about them sort of in passing and doing a book like Black New Jersey, and then it can really just grab you. And so her story is something which is unforgettable. She's born in East Orange, lives early life in Newark. Her parents are very poor. Her father deserts the family when she's a child. She goes on to be a star student at what was then known as Newark Central High School, is now Barringer. She's a top student, and unexpectedly she drops out of high school and has very quickly two babies. And that should have been sort of the end of her. But she's got a lot of ambition, and she goes back to school, enters Howard University without telling anybody that she's been married and now divorced and that she has these two children, gains a key mentor in the person of Lucy Diggs Stowe, who is the legendary dean of students at Howard, and goes on to get an MA first and then later a PhD at Columbia University. And her PhD dissertation, The Education of Negroes in New Jersey, which is still a very usable text, I mean, it's not dated at all, tells about the story of Black education and by extension of Black life in New Jersey from the colonial period right through the Reconstruction times into the 20th century and then up into 1940. And then she continues that work while she's a professor at Howard during the 1940s and 1950s. She kind of branched out. She's an historian of ideas. She goes certainly an intellectual historian, but she's also interested in students. She does a lot of work on counseling. And she said, we pay so much attention to the gifted students. We had to also think about the ordinary, the sort of middle of the road students at Howard and what they're doing. Of course, the students at Howard are going to be the elite of Black America. So she's teaching them for almost three decades. So she's a really significant person. She has key articles on New Jersey in newspapers, in the Pittsburgh Defender, Pittsburgh Courier. And then later on, she does additional articles for Phi Alpha Theta. She works and for the Journal of Negro History. She is the book review editor for the Journal of Negro Education for decades. She's a really significant figure. And sadly enough, those early parts of her life come back to haunt her. And she commits suicide in 1962, just when she was embarking on this major project of a biography of Lucy Diggs Slough. And it's kind of, to me, it's a very interesting thing because here's somebody who's such an intellectual force and so deeply engaged in the life of the mind, but depression and the sad decisions that she made in life, that iron will of ambition, eventually break because of the loss of her children. Because right. She loses them after her husband gains custody. She's never close to them really again. I mean, she has some relations, but it's not the kind of maternal relation you would expect. But I mean, she's somebody with whom we get this whole mix of possibilities. I mean, back to your interest, for example, in Black women's organizations, she belongs to all of them. Mm-hmm. But was it enough? Apparently not. So, I mean, what's happening is I'm editing a compilation of her book and our key articles for publication by Rutgers University Press. And I'm little by little.
Great.
Yeah, well, it will be. Her name bestoons the annual lecture for Black History for New Jersey. It's the Marion Thompson Wright Lecture. But her book is out of print. It shouldn't be because, as I said, it's still a viable book. But, I mean, she also does a lot of other really interesting writing. She does really good book reviews. And so I got a review that she did of a Du Bois book and also one of Chester Himes. So she's somebody we have to get a sense of these Black intellectuals from the period of Jim Crow and, you know, all the substantial things that they did.
So that actually feeds into our last question. And it's what are your plans for future research, either this work you're doing on Wright and beyond?
Well, yes, I do. I'm kind of interested in, and I probably will eventually do a biography of Wright because I'm in touch with her family. I've got a lot of photos of her. Got some fascinating letters. I know a lot more things about her than any of us have ever really known before. So there's mm-hmm. a real possibility of at least a short biography, and I think it would be very useful. Beyond that, my big project is on the Underground Railroad writ large as Black flight in the Americas from 1550s up to the 1870s. And so this is a way to recast the Underground Railroad as a many-centuried struggle against enslavement, the drive for freedom by ordinary people. So that's a big project, and I've got an NEH fellowship this year to try to do something on it, and I'm trying to do that. Beyond that, also, just out of sort of tangentially, my school at Colgate University has asked me to develop a film script on Black men at Colgate. This is kind of a fun thing to do about the Black men who were at Colgate between the 1840s and ending up with Adam Clayton Powell Jr. In the 1940s. So there are a lot of little small projects, but those are the things I'm sort of working on. Mm-hmm. I'm glad my taxi book has got a new edition for the Uber era, which is just coming out right now. And I was really glad to do that because, Uber is a significant challenge to the way taxi driving has been done. And I think that I'm a big defender of the medallion system, as you can see in that book. Mm-hmm. So, I try to stay very active because it's such a great job And as you know, if it works right, being a professor is one of the best jobs in the world.
It is. I agree with that. Well, Dr. Hodges, we have taken up enough of your time this morning, but I want to thank you for participating in this interview about your important book, Black New Jersey.
Well, I'm very glad to be a part of this and always willing to, yes, talk about myself and my books. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Hetty.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to your book on Marion Thompson Wright.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.